So, our topic for tonight is the Zion Mule Corps and the Jewish Legion. So, last week I mentioned that there were three leading Zionist figures who early on...
Connection?
No, that's going to be later on, 1948. Last week I mentioned that early on in World War I, there were three leading Zionists who came to the same conclusion, that something must be done to facilitate British victory in the war, and that Jews need to participate, but each one chose a different angle. Last week was Neely, Spycraft, Aaron Aronson, to help the British by means of gathering intelligence and allowing them to defeat the Ottomans in Palestine. Next week we'll talk about Chaim Weizmann and the diplomatic angle and the Balfour Declaration. But tonight we'll talk about Vladimir Jabotinsky and the founding of the Jewish Legion, the notion that Jews are going to participate in the war effort as actual fighters under their own banner, on one side of the war, in the best interests of Jewish peoplehood and the Jewish nation. So, before we can get to that, to think about, logically, what side of the war would the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, or for that matter, the Jews of the diaspora, want to be in World War I? What's the logical side to be on?
Not the British.
Why?
Because the British were the ones who were not doing what they wanted them to do.
Well, eventually they will, though.
Yeah.
But they were safe under the Ottomans.
Okay, so
right, yeah.
there's an argument to be made that you have to, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, be loyal to the current administration.
Lest
the current administration find your siding with the enemy to be treasonous and do very bad things to you.
Right.
So the Ottomans have the capacity to harm the Yishuv in a big way if they think the Yishuv is disloyal. That may be reason enough to not be disloyal and to side with that team in the grand war. There is another theory, and that is you want to be on the winning team. Not just on the team that could potentially harm you in the short run, but you want to be on the side that ultimately wins, because when the war is over and the fate of the various territories is determined, you want to be on favorable terms with the side that's going to determine the outcome. Well, who's going to win the war? And the answer is Germany. The Germans are the smartest, the strongest, the most brilliant people in the whole world. The Germans are the greatest of all the races. I mean, the Germans, you know. How could you defeat the Germans? So there was a strong contingent that believed and could not be dislodged from this belief that the Turkish-German alliance was going to win the day. That even though the Ottoman Empire was the dying man of Europe and was inherently weak, their alliance with Germany, and for that matter Austria, meant they would win the war. So, don't cross them, or they'll bury you. Another consideration in favor of siding with the Turks, and that is that the other side is France, England, and Russia. And Russia is Kishmo Kane Hu. Russia. All right? Resh Shin Ayin. Russia. And many of the Jews of the Yishuv are expatriate Russians, some of them still holding Russian citizenship because they have not been Ottomanized yet. They hate the Tsar. Well, if you hate the Tsar, you don't want his team to win in this big European war. So root for the other side, namely the Germans and the Turks. This constellation of political thought was quite popular in late 1914 in Eretz Yisrael, and David Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, ultimately the great leaders of Medinat Yisrael in the early statehood period, they subscribed to this viewpoint. But they were overtaken by events, to use political language. Yeah?
To what extent was the historic anti-Semitism of France and England
So I don't think that much, because you could just as easily say there's historic anti-Semitism in Germany. Everybody's guilty of it at one point or another. and even the Ottomans, including right now. So the Ben-Gurion theory of siding with the Ottomans was overtaken by events insofar as Jamal Pasha, who was in charge on the ground, decided to reject the offer of a battalion of Jewish forces, Meretz Yisrael, fighting in the Turkish army, but rather that Zionism would be suppressed and there would be mass expulsions from Eretz Yisrael. So, if you were not an Ottoman citizen, if you were an enemy citizen, namely from Russia, and still held that kind of passport, you were kicked out of the country. To where? So some to the United States, including Ben-Gurion, but many to Egypt, to Alexandria, and to Cairo. As we mentioned last week in the Aronson story, there's a strong expatriate community in Egypt, which will play a role in tonight's spiel as well. Egypt is British. Okay. So, well, not exactly, because they couldn't fight for the British just yet. There'd have to be some bureaucratic maneuvering to make that possible. Right, which is why Neely was very successful. Okay, so the anti-Ottoman perspective, what accounts for that? It's very simple. The Jabotinsky crowd, and Jabotinsky was a Russian Jew born in Odessa in 1880, grows up in a very assimilated environment. Odessa had not too much Yiddishkeit in the conventional sense. He goes off to Italy for 3 years and studies in university, but he's not really much of a formal student. He's just soaking up the culture and the Renaissance. And then he goes back to Russia, becomes a newspaper correspondent, akin to Herzl. He's a better writer than Herzl ever was, much better writer. Is not even fluent in Hebrew. He comes to Zionism in Hebrew later on, in 1903, at the age of 23. And by the way, 23 is an old age to become a convert to Zionism, but in the style of the time. Most kids were there in their teenage years when they had their epiphany. But at the age of 23, there's the Kishinev pogrom. And that pogrom, Jabotinsky is involved in creating self-defense units for the Jewish community, that they shouldn't go like sheep to the slaughter. They should fight back, and fight back hard. He was not in Kishinev. He's in Odessa, but the Kishinev pogrom and the disturbances in Odessa led him to form a local committee and other committees in surrounding communities. Ah, who was that? Oh, no, she was not in Kishinev. No, she was in Kiev. He was in Kiev. So, He believes in self-defense, and those people who participated in the self-defense units in Russia in 1903 to 1905, many of them eventually made Aliyah in the Second Aliyah and participated in HaShomer, Bar Giora, HaMagen, all the various defense organizations that existed in Eretz Yisrael up to World War I. So Jabotinsky's job is as a newspaper correspondent, and he somehow is able to wrangle an opportunity for himself, to go to North Africa to check out the war zone, and then makes his way across to Egypt, and it comes across this expatriate Jewish community in February of 1915. Jabotinsky thinks to himself, you know, why has political Zionism not succeeded up until this time? And the answer is simply that the Turks are not willing to relinquish Eretz Yisrael. There's been no movement whatsoever since the days of Theodore Herzl. There's been the build-up of the Yishuv, but in terms of pure politics, nothing, nothing. So when will there be some movement? There will be movement when the Turks are no longer in control of Eretz Yisrael. Well, how do you make that happen? Have the other side win the war. Who's on the other team? Italy, France, and England. Forget Russia for now, they don't matter for the moment.
Well, they withdrew.
Right, which will be an important part of the equation soon enough. But Jabotinsky says to himself, we have to find a party to the Triple Entente that will be interested in conquering Eretz Yisrael with the help of Jews fighting under their own banner. Okay? So he tries with Pinchas Rutenberg. Oh, by the way, what is Pinchas Rutenberg most famous for? He was in the news not that long ago, even though he's been dead for 70 years. So Pinchas Rutenberg was famous for the electricity plant at Machanaim, which was just in the news because the Jordanians took it back, the Island of Peace, a couple of weeks ago after a 25-year lease. That's where the electrical plant was, made by Rutenberg. So Jabotinsky sends Rutenberg to Rome, no success. Paris, no success. London, at first, not much success. The Allied powers are not interested, it seems, in having a Jewish fighting force for the purpose of conquering Palestine. Well, what's so important about not just the conquest, but that Jews fought? So in Jabotinsky's mind, if you can't claim that you participated with the shedding of blood, then in the post-war conference, your wishes will be disregarded. Whereas if you do shed blood and you fight valiantly, then we got to take you seriously and give you something of your some of your political aspirations, namely political Zionism. That's what he's thinking. So he faces opposition. What kind of opposition? First of all, the Jews back in the Yishuv think that he's crazy, because he's going to endanger their well-being. As it is, a goodly portion of the Jews have been expelled. And if the Turks get wind of the fact that the Jews as a nation are now under a foreign banner fighting against them, then there'll be further expulsions and further persecution of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. Does that in fact come to pass? Yes, we spoke about it last week, that after the first battle of Gaza, the Jews of Tel Aviv and Jaffa were kicked out of the city and sent packing into the hinterlands. So there was reason, at least so thought the likes of Mayor Dizengoff, not to favor a Jewish legion in concert with the British. Who else opposes the Jewish legion? So the answer is the assimilated Jews in the West. Why? What is anathema to them?
They don't want a nation.
Correct. They object to the very notion of a Jewish nation. It doesn't exist to them. The Jews are just members of the Mosaic faith. And the idea that they should fight in a world war as Jews is to them absurd. How shall Jews fight in a world war? As citizens of whatever country in which they happen to live. So if you're a German Jew, you'll fight in the German army. If you're a French Jew, you'll fight in the French army. But the notion of fighting as a Jew in a Jewish army, there is no Jewish nation. So this cannot come to pass. Yeah.
What about the Vatican?
The Vatican doesn't really play a role here. The Vatican plays a role in Herzl's time in objecting to Zionism, and Herzl has a meeting with the Pope and it doesn't go very well, and the Vatican will play some kind of a role around 1947 with partition, but in World War I they don't seem to be at all relevant. Who else is going to object to this? Well, the British might object. They, who are the targets of Jabotinsky's quest to form this this military unit, why would they object to a Jewish unit? So sometimes it's just base anti-Semitism. The idea of, well, Jews aren't good fighters, so what do we need them for? Even though the offer is being made, we will join your team, Jews are weaklings, what are they good for? Okay. So in this late winter, early spring of 1915, Jabotinsky finally makes some headway. He has a roster of names of Jews in Egypt who are willing to sign up for this military unit. And he goes to the British authorities and says, here it is. We're ready. We're ready. And he's told, well, we're not allowed to, by regulation, have foreign nationals in the British Army. So a regular military unit is impossible. That's not going to happen. However, what can happen is you could create a transport unit to help us in our eastern battle at Gallipoli. That on the eastern front, a transport unit would be most welcome.
Supply
unit, yeah. So Jabotinsky says, no, I'm not interested. Why is he not interested? It's not the glory and the prestige he was looking for. He finds it to be dismissive. So he doesn't like it. His colleague, is Joseph Trumpeldor. Joseph Trumpeldor, who is a Russian war hero, a Russian Jew, who loses his arm in the Russo-Japanese War in 1904, and is the only ranking officer in the whole Jewish ranking officer in the whole Russian army. He made Aliyah to Israel, I think, 1907, and is a Jewish patriot. And he says, you know what? A transport unit? We'll take it. Why? In his view, there's no difference between a transport unit and a military unit. That when the rocket-propelled grenades are being fired at you from Kabul, it doesn't matter whether you're driving a truck or on the ground with a gun. Either way, your life is on the line. Okay? So they're all the same. It's just it's one big military. And he says yes. So what actually happens is that 650 Palestinian Jews in Egypt sign up for the Zion Mule Corps, a mule corps that the British need mules to schlep stuff, materiel, and especially pipes for water supply in the Gallipoli campaign. And they're sent right off to the front by ship, and they have their mules. 562 Jews go with the mules to Gallipoli.
They had actual mules,
yeah. Remember, most of the British military at that time was not yet mechanized. They were still relying heavily upon horses. So for transport, they were relying upon mules. It was a rough battle. Gallipoli was a big failure, all right? And they were being fired upon from every direction, but they acquitted themselves valiantly. And the British knew it. It was said, after the fact, that the Zion Mule Corps, under tremendous pressure, did a great job. Can't complain. And they took casualties. Six of them died in battle. So here they're shedding blood on the side of the right team in this grand World War I. They were removed from battle early in 1916 and remained under nominally under the control of the British military, but back in Egypt. So, as it turned out, the existence of the Zion Mule Corps got their foot in the door. It made possible later on for the establishment of a real Jewish legion in the British Army when the policies changed. So why do policies change? In 1916, what happens? Well, the war is not going very well for England. Not at all. And England had no compulsory draft. It was only volunteer service at that time, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands of British boys were volunteering for the war, and they died. And you run out of people who are volunteering, and then eventually you need compulsory service, and that is put into effect in 1916, halfway through the year. But up until that point, there was something very unseemly going on in the East End of London, namely that the families of British soldiers who were fighting and maybe even dying were going to the post office, which also functioned as the local bank, and cashing their monthly check, their stipend, for the families of soldiers, which was basically a pittance. It was barely a way to survive. But they needed it because the head of the household, the man of the house, was away at war. But on that very same line, to get into the post office, which was also a bank, there were people who spoke either no English or a broken English who came from Eastern Europe and were Jewish. And they were cashing their checks. And it was a lot bigger check. Why? Because what were they doing? They were in the tailoring business. The Jewish tailors from Poland and from Russia who were living in East London and the other major cities in England were war profiteers. Now, not really war profiteers. They were like Lower East Side needle trades people. They were making a parnassa because uniforms had to be produced for the war effort. So they were not striking it rich, but they had a livelihood that happened to be better than the widow and orphan of the British soldier. This could lead to anti-Semitism. Well, nobody wants anti-Semitism unless, you know, even the British don't want anti-Semitism. Even British anti-Semites don't want anti-Semitism. So something has to be done to change the calculation here, that Jews who are living in freedom in England who are not contributing to the war effort need to be made to contribute. So one way is we'll have compulsory draft and include even foreign citizens. That far would never they would not do. But the idea of conscripting on a voluntary basis people into the British Army under some sort of a Jewish auspices, that they would go for. And in 1917, they finally say yes, about midway through the year. There is an agreement to establish a Jewish Legion. Jewish Legion. When this arrangement was made, Jabotinsky is the first one to sign up. He becomes a British soldier. And the deal is that this unit is allowed to fight wearing Jewish insignia on a uniform. What kind of Jewish insignia? Star of David, some Hebrew lettering maybe. But it turns out that that deal was not adhered to. That they, at least during the war proper, the Jews fought with a British uniform and there was no obvious Hebrew or Jewish signage. After the war, there would be briefly such a moment when they would have such a uniform. Okay, so where are these soldiers going to come from? These Jewish soldiers. Jabotinsky had been making all sorts of promises that he could find thousands and thousands of them. Where are they going to come from? Any ideas? Okay, yeah.
Especially after 1917.
Okay, so the answer is that Jabotinsky believed there would be Jews in Egypt, which would form the core of the kernel of the Zion Mule Corps. There would be Jews in England who were not available for the regular part of the draft, but who would respond favorably to a call to fight under a Jewish flag. There'd be Jews in some neutral countries, and especially the United States. Now, the United States before April 17th, 1917 is not in the war, so any Jews there could voluntarily decide to join the war effort on behalf of the Jews. And then after America enters the war, well, not everyone was taken in the American army, especially if you were not a U.S. citizen, and there were plenty who were not U.S. citizens, that if they wanted to sign up for some British fighting unit, then call a kavod to you. You can go right ahead and do it. So Jabotinsky figured there might be 50,000 Jews who would be interested in this kind of project. As it turned out, it was much less than that. But still, all over the world, including in America, you have such Jews who are interested in fighting. Well, what changes, what causes a change in British attitude? In part, it was the Russian departure from the war. Since Russia was no longer holding up the Eastern Front, but rather you have the Bolshevik, Kerensky regime, from February to October of 1917, and he wants out, and then Lenin, of course, wants out. So the Jews of Russia are no longer under the Tsarist boot, and therefore Jews around the world no longer have reason to hate Russia, and therefore hate Russia's team in the war. So there's less of an inclination to despise the British, which means more people might be interested in joining. And also, the British want to make sure that they don't lose the support of world Jewry in the broader war effort. So one of the ways you throw them a bone, whether through the Balfour Declaration or through creating a Jewish fighting unit, if that's in fact what the Jews want, so give it to them. Okay. Well, the unit is established, and they're training in England, and they're training, and they're training, and it's taking a long time. In fact, too long. So that the Jewish Legion does not participate in the conquest of the holy places in Israel. Allenby walks on into Jerusalem on December 11th, 1917. And when I say he walks in, I mean literally, he walks in. He gets off his horse, unlike the Kaiser, and walks in as a matter of respect for the holy places. Not like a conquering hero, but just as a simple soldier. So there is no Jewish Legion at that point on the ground in Eretz Yisrael or in the Middle East. They're still off in Europe.
Why did it take so long to train?
Well, this may have been intentional. It may have been that the British want the advantages of having said that they will establish a Jewish fighting force, but not to have that fighting force really be involved in any glorious campaign, and not then to have any hold, political hold, over the British when the post-war settlement is arranged. Okay. So, arguably, it's in part a sham. However, the Jews do arrive in Eretz Yisrael in early 1918, and the war has gotten bogged down. After the conquest of Jerusalem, there really is no major offensive for 6 months. Then, with the Jewish Legion in place, in the summer of 1918, with the front line being about 15 miles north of Jerusalem, somewhere in southern Samaria, there is the call, charge! Now fight! So attack the Turks. And at first it's repelled, but then it's successful. Jabotinsky participates in some fighting, some skirmishes near the Jordan River, and they conquer the Jordan River bridges, which supposedly played an important role in eventually leading to a victory in Damascus. Allenby got a name on his bridge, yes. So the war continues, and the conquest of the Galilee with the Battle of Megiddo is in October. October 30th, 1918, the war ends, at least in the eastern provinces. And all of Eretz Yisrael is under British control. At that time, at the high point, there were 5,000 members of the Jewish Legion. 5,000 members. Where did they come from? So about 30% were from England. About 35% were from the United States. And about 30% were Israeli Palestinian Jews in Egypt who then went back to Eretz Yisrael. 92 of these 5,000 were Ottoman citizens who were captured as prisoners of war by the British, who then were released on condition that they change teams and put on a British uniform, which was perfectly fine because these were not ideological Ottomans. These were just Jews of Israel who happened to be conscripted in one army and then go to the next army. These things happen in World War. So it was a diverse bunch. But what's interesting is what happens to the Jewish Legion after the war is over. I mean, their contribution to the war effort was minimal, and everyone knew that was going to be the case all along. But, and here's the important thing, Jabotinsky recognized that a group of 5,000 soldiers, or even if he could have 10,000 soldiers, he didn't know how many he was going to have, but even if you have that kind of number, in the West, in the trenches in Belgium and France and Germany, those numbers are insignificant. That number of people died every day in the trenches. But in the eastern provinces, that number is significant. It cannot just be ignored and laughed off as being irrelevant. So that's why he felt that there really would be military value to a Jewish legion, as long as it was fighting in Eretz Yisrael, in an area where the total number of troops was on the low end of the scale. So when the war is over, and they've done their fair share, what happens to these people, these members of the Jewish Legion? So what is the Zionist hope for this Jewish Legion? You tell me. What do you think they're hoping for? Well, there is no Israel.
I know. So they're looking at the big picture.
But the big picture, take a step back. The big picture is there's going to be British control over Eretz Yisrael. Control means a military force, an occupation force. Well, who's going to participate in that occupation force? Are it going to be guys from Manchester named Johnny, or guys from Plonsk, then Yafo named Ben-Gurion? So who's going to be in this occupation army? The answer is, well, it's yet to be determined. There's going to be a lot of ethnic Brits, because it's the British Army, but you're also likely going to have some locals. Who are the locals? Well, Arabs and Jews. But if the Jews fought in a British Army unit, and they're on the ground already, maybe that 5,000 can be sustained as the police force, or as the occupation force in Eretz Yisrael, which will mean that what? It can't be horribly anti-Semitic because it has a heavy Jewish component. And if there's a problem with the local population, namely the Palestinian Arabs, then there'll be Jews with guns to stop the worst atrocities from happening. Jabotinsky thought along those lines. Others didn't think along those lines, and why not? Because remember what I told you a few weeks ago? People thought Zionism was a peaceful enterprise. Nobody was anticipating in Herzlian times that Israel would be a garrison state fighting a perpetual war against its Arab neighbors. We know that now because we live now. But 120 years ago, they didn't think that way. Jabotinsky, already in the 19-teens during the war, had in his mind, we're going to need Jews with guns, and a lot of them, and we'll take it even under a British flag, because in the moment, that's what we're going to need. Okay, so did it work out that way? Not really, not really. That's not what happened. So, when the war is over, the Legion is whittled down, its numbers are considerably dropped, in late 1918, early 1919, by people being demobilized. The British don't want there to be a major Jewish component to their occupation force or even to the police force. They don't want it. And I said last week that during 1918, 19, and 20, the British administration in Palestine was very anti-Jewish, very anti-Jewish. Whereas in London, at the cabinet level, so you have Lloyd George, Arthur Balfour, and guys like Winston Churchill already, who are pro-Zionist and will issue declarations that we recall even today as being very important. But that's in London, in a cabinet room with guys wearing stuffy suits. In country, the occupation force was mostly British soldiers who had been fighting with Arabs and who were pro-Arab and didn't understand why there are European Jews in the Middle East. They didn't get Zionism, and so they were hostile to it. And for 3 years, that was true. It will change a little bit after the San Remo conference and after the British Mandate for Palestine takes legal effect, and you have Herbert Samuel, the first High Commissioner, who's himself a Jew and a Zionist, running the show. But until that happens, it's a dicey go of it for the Jews of the Yishuv.
You said that they were fighting with Arabs? That the Arabs?
They were on the same side as the Arabs, the Lawrence of Arabia crowd. Okay? Yeah. Yes, they very much did. There was a tremendous Jewish representation at Versailles. The American
determination was one of the planks.
So the Jewish representation at Versailles was twofold. One was the Zionist organization, its official representatives and its sort of unofficial representatives, guys like Weizmann. Then there was the American Jewish Congress. AJC Congress, not AJC Committee. All right. So the American Jewish Committee was founded in 1906 by, you know, the cigar-smoking German Jews on Fifth Avenue and Park Avenue, and who thought they ruled the world. American Jewish Congress was founded by Stephen Wise, was pro-Zionist and for the masses, more democratic. It was supposed to exist only for the purpose of representing, in a democratic way, American Jewry at the Versailles Palace and at the Paris Peace Conference. It was supposed to go out of business right after that chapter in its history. What ended up happening is it stayed in business because alphabet soup Jewish organizations don't want to die. When someone's making a parnassa, they don't want to lose that parnassa. So it continued to exist ad hayom hazeh. I think Jack Rosen bought it, made it into sort of his private fiefdom. Well, the World Jewish Congress, the same sort of thing. They don't represent anybody but themselves. Okay, so
wasn't in general after World War I a push for new countries to be formed?
Absolutely, they're the successor states. There are seven successor states in East Central Europe.
Latvia,
Lithuania, Estonia, Czechoslovakia.
You have a lot of new countries that
yes.
carved out, and so it's the spirit of the times. It's a good opportunity.
That is true. The trouble is that Zionism is not asking for a Jewish state. Zionism is asking for the opportunity to build up a presence in a country so that eventually there'll be a Jewish state, but to do so at the expense of the local population who might want democracy now. Okay? So that's the trouble.
Why couldn't they come out and just say at that time, it was such a propitious time to say we want our state?
Because it can't happen yet. Because if it were to happen, it would be non-democratic. Because the population is skewed dramatically the other way.
Not enough Jews.
Okay, so I got a little sidetracked. What was I saying? The Jewish Legion could have served the purpose of being in the occupation force and protecting Jewish interests, but the British don't want that. So they're telling people, you're out of a job. You go home. Well, do people go home? And who's interested in going home? The answer is most soldiers who volunteer to fight are eager to serve in combat. They don't want to die in combat, but they're eager to serve in combat, and they want the glory of combat victory. But when combat is no longer happening, nobody wants to stick around and waste years of their lives in nothingness, where nothing is happening, but we're at a barracks in uniform polishing our boots. It's pointless. Well, whether they're getting paid or not, they didn't go for the money. The point is, life goes on, and you want to live an ordinary life, not a useless life in a non-functioning military outfit. So, some of the Americans go home. After all, it was their intention to fight the good fight during the war, but not to settle in the Middle East. They would go back to New York, wherever they came from. British Jews, same thing, go back home. All right. Some, however, do stay. Those who had strong Zionist convictions and who went not just for the glory of the fighting, but because of an idea of establishing a Jewish homeland in Eretz Yisrael, so some of them would stay in country. Others who had been Israeli Jews to begin with and had been exiled to a foreign place and then came back under the auspices of the Legion, of course they stayed, and Ben-Gurion falls into that category. But the numbers are declining, and the British are happy that that's the case. Then, in 1920, something unpleasant happens. You have the first real Arab riots against the Yishuv, where people get killed. It's not nearly as bloody as 1929 or as widespread as 1936 to 1939, but in Yerushalayim, it's ugly. It's a bad scene. And something needs to be done to protect the Jews.
So,
unclear, but propaganda from the Husseini family about the influx of European Jews and the sanctity of the holy places. The holy places is always a stock answer. They're threatening the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they're threatening the Noble Sanctuary, you name it. In the early phases, remember, there's no Palestinian secular nationalism. There's only religion. So if you want to rile people up, you use religion. And Jabotinsky, knowing that there are still legionnaires in country who have weapons, and some of whom have not even been demobilized, gathers together some fighting force to protect the community. He's arrested. We were at the house where he was arrested. Remember, I took a picture of it. I have it on my phone. And he's sentenced to a long prison sentence. You know how many years? 15 years in jail.
That's a long time.
So here a man who rallied Jewish fighting forces to the cause of the British during World War I and was rejected multiple times only to be finally accepted and to fight and in combat and to be on the good side of the war, to all of a sudden, 2 years after the war is over, be arrested and sentenced to 15 years in jail for defending Jews from marauding Arabs in Yerushalayim, goes to show you what about British Hakarat HaTov. Well, there was a lot of hypocrisy here, and the British were not our friends. Does he serve 15 years in jail? No. He serves about 3 months in jail, and then... diplomatic pressure was put to bear upon the British on the British administration. He goes back to England, goes back to Israel. He bounces back and forth throughout the 1920s. But eventually will leave Eretz Yisrael in 1929 and then never be allowed back because he supposedly was a rabble-rouser who's causing trouble and lives the last 11 years of his life in Chutz La'aretz, mostly in Europe, but the last few months in the United States, and dies in upstate New York and is buried out in Long Island at Wellwood in 1940. So that is the story of the Legion and Jabotinsky's involvement in the Legion. So, what was the long-term relevance of Jews fighting in World War I? Well, yeah.
It's a template because they tried to do it in World War II.
Correct. And were successful in doing so with the Jewish Brigade in 1944-45, and they fought in Italy. So the long-term relevance is as follows. Number one, it proved that Zionism was not just a political movement of speech, of talking, but rather was willing to participate in world affairs, and therefore is deserving of recognition in the realm of world affairs. I mean, think about it. From 1897 to 1917, you have people who represent a non-existent country, a non-existent nation, but have some parliamentary body called the Zionist Congress, knocking on doors of heads of state and foreign secretaries and foreign ministers, wanting something from them and offering basically nothing. I mean, yes, there was the talk of the Jews paying off Turkish debt in order to get some sort of a charter, but that never happened. That never came to pass. So basically, the Jews are offering nothing but asking for something. Now they're asking for something but offering something substantial in return. Okay, that's the first point. The second point is that if there was anyone who believed that Jews couldn't fight, well, they were proven wrong. The Jews could fight, and fight well, with bravery. So dispelling anti-Semitic canards is important. It's always important. Even at Yom HaZeh, it's important. Next, what's important was the idea that Jews could participate in an administration in Eretz Yisrael under somebody else's auspices. Yes, the Jews were eventually kicked out of the Legion was disbanded, and Jews were not allowed to have any major representation in the British Mandate's police force, but they were not totally excluded. Meaning the idea is Jews can be involved in governmental affairs in their country, when it's not yet officially their country. So you have Jews who participate in the Mandate administration from 1920 to 1947-48. And that has its beginnings in the fact that the Jews fought with the British in the war. Lastly, and maybe most importantly, it is a basis for the Haganah. So many of the Jews who fought in the Jewish Legion were the leaders of the Haganah from 1920 to 1948. Eliyahu Golomb, and plenty of others who achieve high station in the Haganah had their beginnings in the Jewish Legion. And what should not be ignored is that the Haganah Irgun Lehi in the pre-state era are underground military organizations. And they fight as an underground. But what do you need in the long run for the successful defense of a country? An above-ground army, a real army. So, in the history of Zionism, where does the Jewish people get its training in a real army? Well, let's give a few examples. One, the Jewish Legion. Secondly, the Jewish Brigade in World War II. Thirdly, the British Army in World War II. 30,000 Palestinian Jews volunteer their services, including Chaim Weizmann's son, who died as an Air Force pilot. Okay, you need this kind of service. And in the long run, what did David Ben-Gurion prefer when establishing the IDF? Haganah types or British Army types? British Army types. And this led to a big machlokes. If you remember last year, we discussed in 1948-49 with the Palmach and the disbanding of the Palmach. Why? Well, aside from political factors that they were part of Mapam and they were too pro-communist and all that, the other factor was they were not trained as an army. They were trained as an underground fighting force, whereas guys who had served in the British military had real army training.
So
Jordan had the same had the advantage. The Arab Legion was British trained. It was an above ground army, and that was to their great advantage, which is why they held on to the West Bank. Okay, so these are some military considerations. All right, just so yeah.
The favoritism of the Israelis for British equipment and training.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It was only when De Gaulle, not De Gaulle, but the Americans pressured the British to get out.
You're right.
Changed that.
Now, one last little story I want to tell. Yeah. Who was the commander of the Zion Mule Corps? So, it was the name of John Henry Patterson. Who was John Henry Patterson? You never heard of him, right? Well, he was a British officer, an Irishman, but remember, there's no Ireland yet. So, he was in Africa in the late 1890s and was at a camp where they were producing some relevant military equipment, and there were only black Africans present. He was the only white man, only Caucasian. And there was a problem that every other day, lions would come and grab somebody and eat them.
Oh my God,
really? Okay. And somewhere in the sub-Saharan Africa, British East Africa, and Patterson was a brave guy, and he took his gun, a simple pistol, and was able to shoot three lions. And like Samson, take the jaw of the lion, you know? And so he achieved renown as a lion killer, a lion slayer. And he was going to rise up the ranks of the British Army as something of a big gadilla, you know? But what happened was he got caught having an affair with another officer's wife. Got caught red-handed. And that busted him down to a bunch of lower ranks. So he couldn't get an illustrious unit. So when you get caught in that kind of avera, what did they offer you? They offered him the Zion Mule Corps. The Zion Mule Corps. That was his punishment or his reward for his good service and his not so good service. But that it turned out it was a good shidduch because he was pro-Jewish and it worked out very well. Okay, so, yeah.
He said that this was the first time that, you know, the Jews fought on either side.
That's not the case. In prior European wars, Jews had fought on both sides. In the Franco-Prussian War,
right.
In...
You had to be a citizen to fight, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They fought for Napoleon,
they fought against Napoleon. Sure. Ever since the late 1700s, Jews had been fighting on both sides of the European wars. So the answer is because the casualty rate was so high and the combat was so close and so fierce, and you have these odd stories of people being close enough to hear Kaddish being recited or Shema being recited on the other side of the trench. Plus the fact, but this is the most important thing, actually this is by far the most important thing, in the earlier wars, European wars, where Jews fought on both sides, they did so out of a desire to prove their citizenship and to justify their emancipation. Not that they had a great love of fighting for this country against another country, but it was sort of necessary in the evolution of Jewish emancipation in Europe. By 1915, 16, 17, Jews really were avowed nationalists of whatever country from which they were fighting. Meaning the German Jew who dies in the battlefield fighting against a fellow Jew for France meant it with all his heart and soul. He was a real German, and the Frenchman was a real Frenchman. That wasn't true 100 years earlier, or even 50 years earlier, when it was all about proving the justifying emancipation. At least that's the way I think. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Fled the country because they didn't want to be conscripted into the army.
Where is that?
In the European. In the European. Right.
Okay, so...
So in...
Yeah.
I think it was in the Ukraine.
All right, so many Jews...
Yeah, because they didn't
want
to go into the army.
So many Jews fled Russia during World War I to avoid participating in the war.
Right.
It wasn't so easy to escape continental Europe, but they shirked the draft by a variety of means, including self-mutilation of the fingers, or changing the names. So you have guys whose last name is Levy, who's really a Cohen, and guys whose last name is Cohen, who's really a Levy, because they took somebody else's identity. That was commonly done. I mean, the next week we'll talk about this at some length, but the loyalty of Russian Jews and the perceived political preferences of Russian Jews played a significant role in the calculations made by other foreign governments. Whether they were justified in making those calculations in hindsight 100 years later, they probably weren't, because Jews really had no power at all. But people believed, because they were 5-6 million Russian Jewish citizens, or Russian Jewish residents, that their political desires somehow would influence the decisions of the Russian government regarding participation and the siding in the war. It was, in my view, in hindsight, silly, but people really believed it at the time. Yeah.
How do you navigate gingerly what happened 48 hours ago in Florida? These tropes that are being revived about dual loyalties, etc.
I'm unfamiliar. What happened?
About American Jews.
About American.
By a leader who is ignorant.
Oh, you mean at the. Okay, we'll turn off the tape.